This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Jack Petranker. I'm a host for the Spirituality and Mindfulness channel for the New Books Network. And we're here today to talk with Seth Zwieho Siegel, who is the author of a new book called The House We Live In, came out in 2023. And we're looking forward to the conversation. So Seth, welcome. And
good to see you, Jack.
Yeah, and we'll get right into it. So tell me something about your background, or tell our audience something about your background. Kind of a short biography, I guess.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm a clinical psychologist. I was director of a psychology program at a large urban hospital and was on the Yale School of Medicine clinical faculty for about 30 years. I'm just a little bit into psychology now. I don't practice anymore, but I still write about it. So I have a monthly column in the Mindfulness Research Monthly, which comes out every month. And I'm on the review editorship of the Humanistic Psychologist. So I still have a toe in the water when it comes to psychology, but I'm also an ordained Zen Buddhist priest. I run a Zen community here in Westchester, New York. I'm a guest teacher of the Insight Meditation New York Center. I'm a contributing editor to Tricycle, the Buddhist Review. So that's my kind of main role right now as a kind of a Zen Buddhist priest.
Great. So how does that fit into the book? I mean, what led you to write the book, and how does it tie into your background?
Well, there are a couple of things that led to my writing the book. As I think you know, Jack, I wrote a previous book in 2020 that was looking at Buddhist philosophy and Aristotelian philosophy and trying to find some common ground between them in terms of what's the nature of the good life for people. And as I've learned more and more about, as a Zen priest, as I've learned more and more about Chinese language and culture, I've started to read the Confucian tradition, you know, Confucius and Mencius and Shunzi and Zhuxi and Wang Yangming and going forward from there. And I became impressed about the fact that there was a great deal of commonality between the three different traditions, despite their many differences as well. And what I wanted to do is look at all three of them and do a kind of cross-cultural philosophical analysis and try to see what they all had in common to say that might be something that's useful for us today as modern people. I don't want to bring those forward just as they were, but I want to see if these are resources that we can use today in terms of understanding what virtue and wisdom are. So that was one strand, but the other strand was just living in the turmoil that's the United States right now, and I might say the world order as well. And the basic question about how does a pluralistic society with people from many different racial and economic and ethnic and religious backgrounds with different beliefs about what the good life is, how do they manage not to kill each other? How do they manage to somehow get along, reach compromises, and fight fairly about their differences? And that's, to me, a major question. And along the way, I have been reading a lot of John Dewey and reading Dewey's ideas about how social change occurs. And I wanted to tie that into the book too, that the kind of ethics and morals and values that we have are not handed down since time immemorial. They're things that change and adapt to new situations, but that process of change and adaptation is one that takes a long horizon of time. And I wanted to give that perspective as well in the book.
Okay, great. So that's a lot of strands that you're weaving together. Do you think, did you come away at the end with the feeling that it worked?
Well, does it work? I think that the vision that I have of what the good life is in modern society, and the vision of the virtues and the kind of wisdom that contribute to living well both individually and together collectively. I think that that vision works for me. The question is, how much can people come to agree? I mean, I tried to make it as transcultural and transsectarian as I could, but how much can you get enough people to agree on something like that, that it can really make some kind of change? And I guess one of the other authors I've been reading recently is Reinhold Niebuhr, the Protestant theologian, who is very pessimistic about the degree that which people change. He says the biggest problem for people is not their ignorance, but their selfishness. That you can instruct people all you want about what's a better way to live, but if it's against their perceived interest, self-interest, it's very hard to get them to budge. So I don't say I'm optimistic about that, but I think that if more and more people could adopt this as a way of looking at things and a way of valuing things, I think we would be better off. It's just a question of how to get people to do that.
Right, a big question. So I want to quote from your preface where you say, this book's central thesis is that liberal, pluralistic, multicultural democracies require a broadly accepted ethical framework that must be to some degree, at least some degree, transsectarian and transcultural. So you've already talked about some of that, but I think what this brings in is the idea that there has to be a shared or at least broadly accepted ethical framework. So is that kind of the way you see the book unfolding? Is that what you're trying to do in the book?
Yes, I'm trying to make a case that this is an ethical framework that many, if not most people, can agree on today if they thought about it. And that if we all looked at things this way, we could make some significant changes in the way that we're functioning as a democracy.
Yeah. Okay, so the way you approach that, so we're starting to get now more into the substance of the book. The way you approach that is through bringing together these three strands of virtue, wisdom, and flourishing. You have chapters on each of those, and then you have a chapter at the end on connecting, on coming together, I guess you could say. Can you say something about how virtue, wisdom, and flourishing connect?
Yeah, I think, first of all, that virtues are only virtues because they either contribute to flourishing in one way or they actually constitute part of flourishing in one way. But you need to have a larger vision of what the good life is to understand why the virtues are necessary for it and how they help in that way. So, for example, if you're looking at the Buddhist path, practicing compassion is both a way to get to become a Buddha. But once you are a Buddha, it's also one of the qualities that a Buddha has, you know, kind of an unlimited and universal compassion. So we want to talk about the virtues as both leading to a better life, but also exemplifying that better life once you get to whatever that endpoint is. So I think we need some kind of vision of what, for us as modern people living in a pluralistic democratic society, what does flourishing mean for us today? And I think that's an important question because a lot of us are living lives that don't contribute to, that don't lead to flourishing. We're pursuing values, for example, that are promoted by the culture that don't really make people happy in the long run. And people would be better off if they valued something else instead of what they're pursuing right now. So we know from a great deal of psychological research, for example, that pursuing external goods like wealth and beauty, for example, does not, people who pursue those are not happier than people who prefer benevolence and cooperation and fairness, for example, as goals that they want to pursue. Those people are actually happier. And we could all agree that if we weren't so much focused on concentrating wealth and we're more focused on being benevolent and fair to other people, that we'd probably, you can see easily how that would lead to a better off situation for all of us. So I mean, I think that's the thing I wanted to do, is to kind of tie the virtues in and also wisdom in with what it means to flourish. And I kind of enumerate a set of seven virtues that I think are universal to all cultures. That are, and kind of point out how they are, how I understand them and how they're also connected with flourishing. And then I also look at the question of wisdom, and I look specifically at Aristotle's idea of practical wisdom. And what does that really mean? Because Aristotle never really defines it at all. Is that a single faculty or is it a whole constellation of intellectual qualities and so forth? And so I try to break that down too. I think that's an area where we're having a great deal of trouble right now, and people discerning what's true and what's false, who to believe, who's a reliable source and who's not a reliable source, what constitutes evidence and what doesn't constitute evidence. I mean, these are questions that are troubling our society every day right now.
They certainly are. So that list of seven virtues, I don't think I'll ask you to list all seven unless you'd like to. You do draw on other sources besides the Buddha and Aristotle and Confucius. At least you mentioned some other sources. And in the end, you come up with a kind of idiosyncratic list. And I assume that's because you felt that was the one that worked for this society at this moment in time.
Well, what I found was that I think that the virtues that and the idea of wisdom that's exemplified in all three of the ancient traditions, that you can also find them today in other traditions as well. It's not as if we can find them in the Judeo-Christian and Islamic traditions. We can find it in the humanist traditions. We can find it in the African Ubuntu tradition. I mean, no matter where you go, the same kind of values are extolled and talked about, and you find them in the New Testament, the Old Testament as well, and Rabbi Hillel. You know, wherever you look, you find them. So that's what I want to point out too, that although I've drawn them from these ancient sources, they're really kind of universal.
And one of the things you point out, and I think of this as an Aristotelian point, is that virtues very often consist of going to the midpoint between extremes. So could you say something about that?
So for example, Aristotle talks about courage as a virtue. And what he says is courage is the midpoint between rashness and cowardice. Okay, you don't want to be someone who rushes off into every battle, whether it makes sense enough, you know, even if you're a minor force that's, you know, that's destined to lose the battle and everyone's going to get killed. Doesn't make sense. You want it to be you want to use wisdom to moderate courage and tell when it makes sense to fight and when it makes sense to retreat. And it's the same thing with generosity. You want to be generous to friends, you want to be able to give to charitable causes and so forth, but you don't want to give so much away that your family becomes impoverished, for example, or you no longer have a home to live in. So you have to find a kind of a balance between all of these qualities. And it's the same thing with conscientiousness. You want to be conscientious enough to do, if you're an air traffic controller, you want to really pay close attention to everything that's happening. You don't want to make mistakes, you want to be very conscientious. But you don't want to be so conscientious that you become like a type A personality or become an obsessive compulsive, nor do you want to be so lax and relaxed that, you know, you just kind of drift through life purposefully. You want to find that midpoint, that sweet spot.
I suppose in part that's because you're talking about virtues as they're practiced by people living in everyday society. Because it does strike me that, Buddhism, which is what I'm familiar with, you do go to extremes if you enter a monastic community, or you basically, I mean, there's so many stories of the Buddha who does sacrifice everything,
That's right.
but. So the moderation part is partly just, okay, we live in this society, unless we're going to withdraw from this society and withdraw from all of the relationships that we've established, it makes more sense to approach these things in moderation. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, and I also am. I don't talk about it very much in this book, but I've talked about it elsewhere. That I'm fairly critical of the monastic ideal. I don't think it's something that most of us should be aspiring to. I'm not saying that it's not right for some people, and it may even be inspiring that there are such people in the world who do this, and they point out our own limitations and that we could do better at what we're doing. But I don't recommend it as something everyone ought to do or most people ought to do.
Right. Well, it would lead to the speedy demise of everybody if people all became celibate, right? So
That's right.
there's
That's right.
that.
Which may be good for the planet, we don't know.
Right. The final solution to the climate emergency. Okay, let's not try to go there.
Good.
So at one point in the book, you offer a program for developing the virtues. You say take a week and really focus on each one. Is that something you've worked with? Have you had in your community or for yourself, or is it just how did that idea come up, and what kind of experience have you had with that?
Well, I haven't done it quite like it is in the book, but I've done it, for example, with the 16 Bodhisattva vows, where I might take a month on each one and think about what it means, how much am I living up to it, how much am I not, and what does it mean when I'm not? Does it mean that I have to try harder? Does it mean I have a wrong idea about it? You know, just really trying to explore that. And I've done that as well with the perfections, the paramitas, you know, where I've worked on one for a while. And so what I think is really helpful is to, and I've done it with also with the five lay precepts, for example, where, you know, I might work on just one, like, what does it mean not to kill? Okay, well, wait a minute. If I have tuberculosis, I'm going to take an antibiotic and kill those bacteria, you know, or if I have termites in my house, I probably will get some kind of insecticide and not allow my house to crumble. What is it? My white blood cells are killing, you know, bacteria all the time. I mean, what does it mean not to kill? And so that becomes a koan in the Zen tradition. And it really becomes a question of how little killing can I do, you know, and still feel like I have a life well worth living. And I mean, even when you're talking about eating, you know, are you a vegetarian or not? Even if you're vegetarian, you're killing vegetables and so forth. There's a whole question about where are your limits and where's the wise place to be. And I think that's always a process of discovery and exploration. I don't think there are hard rules that say, this is the rule I'm going to follow for my entire life. It may be that we change in our understanding it over time, but I think it's always worth exploring. And the same thing with lying, you know, there are times when lying makes sense, you know, when the Gestapo comes and asks you, are there any Jews hiding in your house? The answer is no, you know, even if there are. Or if somebody shows you a picture of their baby and they say, look at this, and you don't say, oh, what a wrinkly looking baby. You say, what a beautiful baby, it's adorable, you know. There are times when little white lies actually are the right thing to do. There are other times when even little lies are exactly the wrong thing to do, though. And so I think that's a whole process of lifelong exploration, you know, of discovery. There are all kinds of lies, for example, that aren't really harmful, but we tell them to exaggerate something that happened to us to make an amusing story, or to make ourselves look a little bit better or a little bit less worse. You know, these little tiny distortions that we do all the time, how much are they really necessary for our lives? Maybe. So I think each time that we find ourselves telling an untruth, we can ask ourselves the question, was that really necessary? If I were in the same situation again, would I want to do that again? Do I want to contact the person I lied to and make an apology to them, or is that not necessary? You know, these are all areas for very rich exploration, and I think it's the way we grow. One of the main things I got out of the Confucian tradition is and this is true also for Aristotle and the Buddhists, though, is that moral growth, the virtuous growth, is a lifelong process. There's never a point in your life when you're done. So Confucius has a famous quote, for example, where he talks about each decade of his life up to his seventh decade and how his understanding of morality changed in each decade. So I think that's the question for us. Are we growing? I mean, it's not as if moral development ends in late childhood or early adolescence and then we're set for life. We always have a new voice to hear from, or a new problem that arises that causes us to look at things differently. And this is how we grow, by looking at these problematic aspects of what we've believed in the past and trying to understand them better.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So when you're talking about virtue, you say that all three of the traditions that you're relying on practice or advocate a kind of ethics that is what is called by modern philosophers virtue ethics, as opposed to, say, consequent utilitarian ethics or
deontology.
Rule-based. Yeah, deontology. I was going to try to avoid that word, not to scare people off, but rule-based ethics, deontology. Do you think, I mean, that's your approach too, then, is basically to cultivate the virtues, clearly, because that's one of the main themes of the book. But doesn't the consequential, I mean, there's always the question of whether the consequentialist view, the utilitarian view, has to play in at some point.
Well, it does. I mean, if you're evaluating your actions and you're finding out that you had an intention to do something, but actually the absolute opposite occurred inadvertently, you have to learn from that. You don't want to keep on doing the same thing again, even what you're doing is harmful. So yes, I mean, it matters a great deal whether your actions are actually harmful or actually beneficial or not. But I don't think it can be the only measuring stick that we use. I think some things are just good in their own, without having to wonder so much about the consequences, you know.
I suppose the utilitarian part comes in partly with this idea of the virtue being a midpoint, you know, because, you know, you might think, well, virtue is a virtue. I've got to do that. But you're aware of the consequences. You use the example of rashness and courage.
Yeah, too much courage is rash, or too much honesty is rude, you know, and
right,
so forth.
Right, 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 exactly. Yeah,
too much justice is merciless, you know, and mm-hmm. so on, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there's a great line in a Paul Simon song about there's no tenderness in your honesty.
It's, yes, exactly right.
Yeah. So when you come to talking about wisdom, you start off at least by saying that, you know, there's received wisdom and then there's practical wisdom, the phronesis, as Aristotle terms, you know, I am scaring people off.
Yes, you are.
And then there's emotional intelligence. So would you say that there has to be a blend of those three?
Well, I talk about emotional or social intelligence as part of practical wisdom. It's one part of it, but not all of it. So I just want to be clear that when we're talking about wisdom, we're not just talking about being able to use the hypothetical deductive method, you know, mm-hmm. and be able to know logic the way that Aristotle, for example, understood logic. But there's more involved in it. There's a mindfulness involved. There's the wisdom of the body that's involved. And there's also a whole kind of being able to read social situations. And there's a whole set of skills about how to deal with other people effectively, you know, that are also part of practical intelligence. For Aristotle's definition of practical intelligence was doing the right thing in the right way at the right time. And it's very much like the Buddhist idea of right speech, you know, that speech not only has to be gentle and well-intentioned, but it also has to have the positive effect. You know, if some piece of truth that you're giving someone else isn't going to be useful to them and just going to raise hostility, it's not the time to say it. So you have to, it's that whole kind of question of being able to judge, you know, practically what the effects of your action are going to be.
You also talk about the importance of speaking from the heart. And when I read that, I thought, well, that must have to do with your practice as a clinical psychologist. That's pretty fundamental. Is that right?
It is, yeah. But it's also, I think, true of Buddhism as well, that, you know, speaking from a very authentic place, mm-hmm. Speaking a kind of truthfulness that comes out of a kind of a beneficial intention mm-hmm. to others in the world.
Yeah, and I suppose wisdom has to do then with connecting to that place in your heart where you can speak authentically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But I guess the other thing I want to say is that the other thing I got from Confucius, and this is true for Buddhism as well, he said that of all the virtues, there's one that's like the prime virtue, and that's benevolence or human-heartedness or humaneness. There's a kind of sense of goodness of intent and purpose towards other people, and a natural affection and caring and tending to others that he says is like the prime virtue. And I think that's true for Buddhism as well, when Buddhism talks about loving kindness and compassion as the prime virtues.
Yeah. And it's related. You have a section that I particularly liked on wholeheartedness. Now that comes up in the chapter on flourishing, which we haven't so much talked about yet. But I would think that those come together. You know, that again, acting from the heart and wholeheartedly, and then being wholehearted in your engagement with others. Right. So that's where the benevolence and compassion comes in.
Yeah, and the wholeheartedness really comes from the whole Buddhist tradition, the whole Zen tradition of being present in the moment, but being authentically present in the moment, so that when you're with another person, you're authentically with them in that moment in a kind of an I-thou relationship.
Right.
And that certainly comes both from my past as a psychologist, and also from my past, I also worked for a number of years as a chaplain in the hospital, and the idea that you're just meeting someone you've never met before, ever, And you're only going to be with them for a certain short period of time. It's not like you're going to see them for weeks or months like a psychotherapist. You have one time, one meeting. Okay. And the question is, how can you make this an authentic thing that's transformative for this person? And it means both of you find some way to speak directly from the heart in that moment.
Right.
And it's transformative when it happens. It really is.
I'm tempted to tell a story, but this is not about me. This is about you. So I will resist that temptation. Let's talk about the.
I want to say one thing about wholeheartedness. That the other thing is about savoring, so to speak, the events that occur within each moment, giving them some attention, because I think a lot of the richness of the texture of life comes from our ability to be present, not in our heads somewhere, but to be actually there with whatever is happening. And that's why I included in the chapter on flourishing, because flourishing means more than just making some accomplishments or having some relationships, but it means being fully present and wholeheartedly present with all of that. If we can live that wholehearted way, that transforms our entire life in magical ways, I think.
Yeah, that's nice. So flourishing. So again, we'll use a scary Greek word, eudaimonia. Which is the Greek word that gets translated usually as flourishing. Do you think that that's different in the different systems, or do you think that they can be treated collectively?
It is different. So, you know, I talked about this in my previous book a bit, the difference between enlightenment, for example, and eudaimonia. There are aspects of the Buddhist model of how well we can live that go well beyond eudaimonia. So there's a belief that we can kind of reach this kind of, I would say, transhuman state, where we've transcended the problems of ordinary life and ascended to some higher level in which there's a perfection of well-being, as well as a perfection of goodness and decency in your life. Aristotle is much more practical about that. He says, I don't think that's really possible for most, certainly for most people, not for me, he would say. You know, we can always do better than what we're doing, but there's no end point of perfection that we can reach. And of course, there are parts of the Buddhist tradition that say that as well, that there isn't any final enlightenment. There's enlightenment beyond enlightenment. You know, Dogen talks, for example, of going beyond Buddha, for example, Buddha beyond Buddha. There's always, no matter how big your awareness is, or your understanding is, or your compassion is, it's always possible for it to be more. There's no final end point. And life is a journey towards that mythical, hypothetical endpoint that doesn't really exist, you know. I think that there are aspects, metaphysical aspects, ontological aspects of enlightenment. For example, enlightenment in Buddhism means the end of transmigration, you know, from lifetime to lifetime. It involves some kind of ontological commitments to there being some existence beyond the bodily existence, for example. And those are things that aren't part of eudaimonia. So I think it's possible to separate them out, but there are also things they have in common. So I don't want to say there. I would say that eudaimonia is like a milder, a milder level of enlightenment.
Okay, and then the whole question. Excuse me, enlightenment light.
Enlightenment light. Yeah.
So what about the distinction? And this will start to get toward the kind of social dimension of what you write about. Between social flourishing and individual flourishing, I mean, you know, it seems like one of the things you say, I think, and maybe we'll talk about that more later, is that one of the goals of society should be to promote individual flourishing. But there's also the question of the whole society flourishing.
Right? Absolutely. Well, first of all, as an individual, you can't flourish really if the rest of society isn't flourishing. If you're living in the middle of civil war and discord and climate change and everything else, there's no way that you can really flourish. Even if you're at the apex of the economic order, you know, and you have more money than anyone else, if the whole society is in disarray, you have to hire bodyguards to make sure that you're not kidnapped or your children aren't kidnapped. You know, if everyone is doing what they ought to be doing in a society, then we're all flourishing. If one group isn't flourishing and it's going to cause an insurrection against the power of the wealthy and so forth, that's not really flourishing either. So I think that's the first thing I want to say, that we want to live in a society in which there isn't civil disorder, where people find ways to kind of manage their disagreements, where people don't cheat each other and steal from each other and kill each other. And, you know, life isn't, as Hobbes said, you know, a war against everyone. We want to live in a society where judges do their job, where policemen do their proper job, you know, where where bankers don't discriminate. You know, we want that kind of world. And so I think it's our job to do everything we can to see that the world we live in is that kind of world, where everybody has the opportunities to flourish in the way that makes the most sense to them, as long as their vision of flourishing doesn't cause undue harm, you know, to other people that we care about, you know. So that's the vision I want to provide. And it's kind of John Dewey's definition of democracy, which is democracy is a form of organization which everybody works together to create the conditions for maximum flourishing in everyone in the society.
Right. So I do want to talk about that, but maybe we'll put it off just a little bit. I want to go into one of the things you say, which is that part of flourishing consists of making a connection to something greater than ourselves.
Yeah, one of the dimensions of flourishing I talk about is the dimension of meaning, that our lives have to feel meaningful to us, and lives can be feel meaningful in all kinds of ways. But for most of us, for the average person, for me, I'm speaking for everyone, right? For me, meaningfulness means that the people that I come into contact with most frequently feel that their lives are better because I'm present in it in some kind of way. It's kind of like that movie, It's a Wonderful Life. You know, if I wasn't mm-hmm. here, would things be better or worse? For most of us, that's what it means. But for other people, it may mean something else. It may mean being part of a larger movement in history or a cause of some kind. You know, I think about dedicated revolutionaries, or I think about scientists working for a cure for cancer or something like that. They have some kind of larger view of what they're working on, that they want to make some contribution to the whole world, so to speak. And other people get their connection to nature, or a kind of a sense of a cosmic connection to everything. I mean, there are all different ways we can make meaning in the world. But I think being deprived of meaning is the worst. You can't flourish unless you have some sense that my life has some kind of connection to a larger story of my community and of mankind and the future.
I suppose some people would say, you know, it has to do with family and friends and just, you know, my connections there and being able to support the people I love.
Right. And that's being meaningful to the people around you, that they're better off because you're doing your job in the world.
Okay. You say that flourishing, and actually I think you say virtue and, you know, maybe even wisdom, that they emerge through a process of collective inquiry, and you take that from Dewey. You're very specific about that. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, what I would say is that so the kinds of rules we have about what's the good way to live, those have been settled throughout history, you know, by a general process of, you know, it's good for us not to kill each other. You know, we come to that kind of agreement, so historically. And we still kind of agree with that for the most part. It's a pretty good rule, you know. Or if we're going to kill people, we had better have a damn good reason, you know, and ones that the people around us would approve of in some kind of way. But anyway, whatever solutions we reach, whatever conclusions we reach about what's the right way to live, they can become problematic at some point. Social structure changes, new inventions come about. You know, think about, for example, the way the birth control pill changed the way we look at sexual morality in the 1960s and so forth. There can be some change that happens, and then you have to inquire again. Well, is what we used to think still right? You know, how important is virginity, for example, before you marry? It used to be very important. Now, not so important, at least not in Western, you know, postmodern cultures. So the question is, how does that change? How do people's views about what's important change? And the point is that that's always a matter of contestation. You know, can people decide that they're transgender? You know, can homosexuals marry and be in the military? Okay, people used to have one opinion of it. That opinion has changed. How does it change? There's a social discussion that goes on. And often that social discussion takes a very long time. So for example, the question about should women be able to vote took about 75 years to settle. The question about the world agreed that slavery was a normal way of doing things for thousands of years. You know, all of a sudden in the 1800s, that changes. How long did it take for people to change their minds about it? Well, again, it took maybe 7,500 years before, and the whole world changed at the same time. The Russians abolished serfdom you know, around the same time as the American Civil War. So there are changes that are occurring through local and global conversations, but it's very slow change. And I think that's the appalling thing, is that sometimes the change has to be slower, because that's just the way social processes occur. There's always going to be difference of opinion. People have to argue it out. The way they usually end is not that people change other people's minds, but that one point of view in the discussion dies out and a new generation comes up, or some new problem arises that changes everybody's mind and they focus on that instead. You know, it's interesting. For example, we can talk about problems that get solved peacefully, like the question about whether Mormons can engage in plural marriage. Okay, that was a big issue, you know, when Utah wanted to enter the Union, you know, as a state. It's not a big issue anymore. I mean, people have different opinions on it, but it's not a big issue. Should stores be closed on the Sabbath? Okay, that used to be a big issue. It's not so much a big issue anymore. So sometimes these get resolved over time peacefully, and other times, like in the Civil War, they don't get resolved peacefully. So that becomes an important question, you know, what can be resolved peacefully and what can't. I think the current fight over abortion is an example of another contentious issue that is difficult to see how it can be resolved now. And yet at the same time, I can imagine 10, 20, 30 years from now, it may disappear as an issue. There was a time, for example, when it wasn't an issue. In the year 1900, it wasn't outlawed in any state, abortion. Okay, people just had them, midwives performed them. Then the obstetricians came about as a profession, and they were in competition with the midwives, and they were the ones who decided that abortion had to be banned to help create their greater power over the midwives. But that's how it began. And then in the 1970s, it wasn't an issue that divided religions, at least not Protestants from Jews, for example. Billy Graham wasn't, you know, universally opposed to abortion. The whole evangelical movement, you know, was open to abortion under certain conditions and so forth. And that changes when, you know, the Republican Party under Nixon decides they want to mobilize Catholics out of the New Deal coalition. And then it gradually becomes politicized, and then it becomes an issue for evangelicals down the line. But just as things weren't an issue and then become an issue, you know, they can not become an issue again later on. It's a kind of an interesting process. So it's interesting to note that the most liberal abortion law in any state in the United States was signed by Ronald Reagan, for example. I mean, there used to be that Republicans and Democrats did not differ on this issue.
That is interesting. And it's, you know, the idea that you can take a kind of historical view and say, well, you know, this too shall pass and things are going to change. That would be very helpful. But of course, we're living in a particular moment in time. So,
right. And then there's the issue of climate change, which we don't have time to fix. And at the other time, on the other hand, social processes are slow, and getting everyone on board is a slow process. So we're really in a bind at that point. We may not succeed.
Yeah, that seems right. I mean, sometimes problems grow faster than solutions, right?
That's always true.
I suppose so. There's always more problems, right?
Well, the other point I make out is that every solution creates a new problem. Mm-hmm. You know, so you invent antibiotics and infectious diseases go away, but now people live longer and get chronic diseases like, you know, cancer and heart disease. So it's, you always have a trade-off. Horses are a pretty messy way to go about, you know, they fill the streets of New York with manure and so forth. You invent the motor car, people are very happy, you know, but then you have to have an oil industry, and you have to have expensive infrastructure, and you have now motor vehicle injuries with, you know, brain trauma, and, you know, all of a sudden you have new problems you have to fix, then global warming. So every solution is only a temporary solution. And that was one thing I got from Dewey, that every solution has to be reexamined later on, you know, to see whether it's still a solution.
So that's a commitment to that process of ongoing inquiry as a society.
That's right.
Wonder how much we really do that. I mean, it seems to me, as you said, it tends to happen more haphazardly or when people die out or something like that. This inquiry is, I don't know how much it's valued in society at large. I mean, scientists, sure, they want scientists to come up with great solutions, but on the social level, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, and there's also a question about how much change can a society go through at a single time without losing its coherence. So I think what I mean, every single value we have is open to question, or could be. And if we threw everything up in the air all at once, it would be a disaster socially. So the good news is we only focus on those that become a problem, you know. But as social change becomes faster, because technological change becomes faster, you know, then there's a question about how much can we tolerate, how much can we endure without going into constant turmoil about what's the right rule that we ought to be able to adopt.
I suppose that's, I'm not sure how much you get into this in the book, but I suppose that's one of the questions that comes up that we do live in a world where change is so rapid that maybe solutions that have worked in the past, or at least have been ideals in the past that people could aspire to, maybe they just aren't going to work anymore.
That's right. So in a society like the frontier society in the United States, when the only weapon that was available was a front-loaded single-shot musket, the Second Amendment made sense. Now that you have assault weapons everywhere, does it still make sense? I mean, conditions change and you have to relook at things again.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that brings us to the last chapter of your book that's called Only Connect, and it has to do with how people can coexist in a positive way. And you talk about having the moral resources to move beyond group loyalty. It seems like that group loyalty is becoming more and more of an issue, right? That's one of our problems right now. People are so committed to their political group, maybe above all, but also, of course, other kinds of connections of, you know, I'm thinking of the evangelicals or whatever. So the question is developing the moral resources to move beyond that. I mean, I suppose one thing maybe you'd say about that is, well, that's where wisdom comes in. Right? Is that a fair statement?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's more of a problem now than it used to be. I mean, I think it's always been the same problem. I mean, I always like to laugh about Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner used to have a routine called the 2,000-year-old man. And 2,000-year-old man remembers ancient history, and he says, the first national anthem was, all of the caves can go to hell except cave number 57. So I think that's the kind of group loyalty thing has always been a problem. And in fact, if you look at Chinese philosophical history, say during the Warring States period, about 200-300 BC, the main problem that all the different philosophies, they had like, in the Chinese, they say it was a period of the 100 philosophies, okay? So it wasn't just Confucianism and, you know, and Taoism and legalism, and they had many different philosophies, but they all revolved around the same essential question, which is, now that we're becoming a nation state, now we're becoming an empire, how much do I just have loyalty to my family and my clan? And how much do I owe broader society in general? And there's always a conflict about that. And I think that's part of the way we're built as human beings, in terms of that we all have a kind of natural tendency to care about others. Okay, if a child cries, we all kind of look to it and see how can we soothe that child. Mencius gives the example of a child about to fall into a well, and you see that about to happen. And immediately anyone would feel shock and alarm at that, you know. If somebody steps on a puppy's paw and it yelps, you go, oh, poor puppy. You know, you see people in the midst of an earthquake digging out in Iran on the evening news, for example, and your heart goes out to these people. So there is this natural impulse to care about people, but we care about our families and the people we see face to face and our friends more than we care about these distant others. It's just the way we're built. The Confucians would say that benevolence starts in the family and then extends out, and that it's a lifelong process of extending it out to other groups. So I think there's a conflict when we understand that we all ought to love our neighbors like we love ourselves, and we all ought to be benevolent towards everyone, and we owe a certain fairness to everyone in society. But we also believe my family and friends first, you know, and when times are flush, it's maybe easy to be generous to other people. And then when there's times are scarce, then you draw the circles around and you just protect your particular group. So I think that's the fundamental conflict we have when it comes to justice and fairness and benevolence, is how much is it tied to our specific group and how much can we extend it beyond? And I think it's always problematic. It's not easy to do. I mean, that's one reason why on a news story about a famine, say somewhere, the news story will focus on one family and what they're going through, one child who's starving, because you can identify with that more than a million people starving. That doesn't make any sense to us. Or are there resources that can help us do that? Yeah, we have all these stories, the story of the Good Samaritan in the Bible, or, you know, there are many stories of the in the Buddha's previous life, is it great acts of compassion towards other beings. We have, I think about 30 times in the Old Testament, it says, love the stranger as you love yourself, not love your neighbor. You know, it's there are these resources that enable us to care about other people, but it's still an upward push for most of us to do it. I think that's a lifetime project of caring about people who are very different from us. You know, you may think you're very good at it, and then you're walking down the street in New York City and you see a homeless alcoholic on the street, you know, who's stinky, you know, and they're asking for a couple dollars, you know, and immediately you're thrown into some kind of turmoil about, should I be generous? Oh, he's just gonna spend it on drink, you know. He's not like us people, why doesn't he get a job? You know, all these kind of thoughts that separate me from that other person come up. And yes, you may make the decision in the end to be generous, and sure, why not? And you may even make it a practice. Whenever someone asks me, I'll give them something, you know, as a way of enlarging your heart in some kind of way, but it's still a push always to do that. So I think it's a problem. I think it's always gonna be a problem. What we can say is that the solutions to a lot of the problems we have in the world require our extending our cooperation with other people and caring about other people more. So that if we're going to solve the problem of infections that come up like COVID in the future, it means not just hoarding vaccines for the wealthy countries, but if you do that and the poor countries don't have them, then new strains just develop in the poor countries and spread to the wealthy countries. You can't segregate yourself out. Or if we're going to solve global warming, it means everyone has to cooperate on it in some way, even if we don't like each other. Or if you're gonna deal with the problem of terrorism or transnational corporations and not paying taxes or whatever the problem is, it takes broader and broader networks of cooperation. You can't just solve problems on your own anymore. So there's that kind of push that we have to think bigger and think wider and include more and more. On the other hand, it's hard for us to do. So maybe we won't succeed at these efforts, you know?
Well, you do make the point, and I think maybe this is a good place to bring our discussion to an end. You make the point that, sure, we're not going to agree. You know, we can't expect to have consensus. But the aim is to remain human in each other's eyes. I thought that was really important.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on that in the book. How do you talk to people who are on the other side of the divide? And I think it's important that if we're talking to someone who has a very different viewpoint of ours, our job is not to convert that other person. That never works, or hardly ever works. You know, just like no one, I can't imagine a Trump supporter could talk to me and make me become a Trump lover. I mean, I can't imagine how that would happen. But it's the same, but the other side is true as well. I can't convince them that he's a bad person, you know, or an exemplar of a very bad person, that he's a psychopath or something like that. So the question is, if we can't convince each other, what do we do? And I think the important thing is we don't demonize each other, that if we talk to each other, if we can find a way to talk to each other, which is open-hearted and present and non-abusive and non-controlling, and just try to hear each other's point of view and understand where the other person is coming from, we're not going to end up agreeing with them, but we'll understand that where they're coming from makes sense from their particular history and their particular environment and where they're coming from. And that we can agree to disagree, but still say, but you know what, we're just still human beings. We're not enemies. We may be competitors. I may have to defeat you, you know, at the ballot box on this particular issue, but it doesn't mean I have to hate you. And so the question is, how can you strenuously fight for the values that are important to you without being against other people? And there I'm looking at the examples of the Buddha and Martin Luther King and Mohandas Gandhi and people like that who said, you know, you have to maintain, you're fighting ideas or conceptions or practices, but you're not fighting people. And that we all kind of find some way to say, okay, you know, what I know some Republicans now call Democrats demoncrats, for example, and that's what we're trying to avoid. Or when Trump calls people vermin, you know, but the left is just as guilty of that as well. This person is a racist, and he's unredeemable because of his particular abhorrent beliefs. Well, you know, when I was growing up in my neighborhood, everybody was racist to some degree. You know, my aunt Harriet, for example, you know, had horrible things to say. But you know what? She wasn't a bad person entirely. You know, she had abhorrent views. We always were arguing with her about them. but she was a very sweet person, and you know, she remembered our birthdays, and you know, she, you know, she,
the things
she,
that really mattered.
She wasn't cruel to people in her everyday life, you know. So you have to honor people, and you have to realize that everybody you love has something wrong with them, okay? And everyone that you know believes something that isn't true, and we have to be generous to each other in some kind of way.
Well, that is a nice place to end, but I realized that I never did ask you something I meant to ask at the beginning, which is the title of the book. Can you explain how you came to call this book The House We Live In?
Yes, I can. It comes from a song I heard when I was in third grade. There was a movie out, I think it came out in 1945 and 1946, that starred Frank Sinatra. It was a short, won some Academy Awards. And it was a kind of an anti-prejudice kind of propaganda film put out by Hollywood called, and the song was The House We Live In. It was sung by Frank Sinatra, became a big hit. Paul Robeson sang it as well. But it includes the verse, you know, what is America to me? And the answer is all races and religions, they're America to me. And when I heard that song in third grade, I said, oh yeah, that's the American credo. And I thought everyone believed it in America. So it was a big shock to understand it was really a propaganda piece, and that a good part of America didn't believe in it, that we still lived. I was too young at that point to understand about segregation in the South, for example, and Jim Crow and everything else. So I understood it was part of a continuing battle in an attempt to include everybody into American society. So I think that's the house we live in. Everybody lives in this house, and we have to find some way to get along and order it, you know, and not kill each other. So that was the idea.
Okay, well, that is a good place to end. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure that listeners will also. So we'll close with that. And tell me, what's your next project? What are you working on?
I'm in the midst of working on an encyclopedia article for the St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology on Western Buddhism and on Western psychology and Buddhism. So I'm finished the first draft, and that's my new project right now.
Okay, great. Well, thanks very much, Seth. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. A pleasure too. Thank you, Jack.